Good day. Today is Thursday, 23rd October 2025. And let me remind you quickly again to tick the like button. If once you've watched the video, you decide that you like the video or like whatever part of the video you have watched or listened to. So with that, let's get forward with the program. And over the course of the last 24 hours, we have had further signs that the relations between the United States and Russia are once again on the pathway towards further deterioration, and that the relations between the American and Russian governments are now worse than they have ever been since Donald Trump was inaugurated president of the United States back in January. Now, over the course of yesterday, President Trump met with the NATO Secretary General, Mark Rutte. He made a number of comments. He said that he had indeed cancelled the proposed summit meeting with Putin in Budapest. By the way, throwing his friend and political ally, the Prime Minister of Hungary, Viktor Orban, in effect under a bus. I'm not going to discuss this in detail in this program, but the casual way in which Trump has treated Orban and the government of Hungary is astonishing, and I suspect will be remembered by people in Hungary in the future. But anyway, Trump confirmed that he'd cancelled the meeting with Putin. The forthcoming meeting with Putin. He said that he still expects to meet with Putin one day, though he didn't say when. He cast doubt on the supply of Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine. He said that the fundamental problem is that the operation of the Tomahawks would require massive training by the Ukrainians, that that would take months to happen, that there was no possibility of the US itself ever operating the missiles by itself. Now, Trump presumably knows that there is no mechanism, no means, given the way Tomahawks operate, for them to be operated by Ukrainians. So when he says that the Ukrainians would require months to learn how to use them, he ought to know, and presumably does know, that if it is left to the Ukrainians, that will never happen. And if, as he also says, the United States will never itself engage in launching missiles against Ukraine, operating Tomahawk missiles, sorry, against Russia, will never itself operate the Tomahawk, any Tomahawk missiles provided to Ukraine. Well, if he means what he says, then that means the Tomahawk missiles will never be provided to Ukraine. I will anticipate by saying that what Trump says about this should not be relied upon. He has just said something else or written something else, which is obviously untrue. And that casts great doubt on what he's now saying about American operation, no possibility of American operation of the Tomahawks. But anyway, continuing further with what Trump said, he also said that he hopes that Putin and Zelensky will one day be reasonable. He reiterated that he wants an immediate end to the war on the current conflict lines. He, in other words, has reverted entirely to his pre-August position of demanding a freeze of the conflict. He said that there would be sanctions against Russia announced later in the day, and that indeed has happened, and I will discuss that shortly. And he again spoke about his great disappointment with Vladimir Putin and about how he has nice conversations with Putin, but that these lead nowhere. And he also said, to conclude, that he felt that a meeting with Putin at this time didn't seem right. Now, on the question of Trump cancelling a meeting with Putin, it is again important to say that this is Trump cancelling a meeting with Putin, which it was Trump who proposed to Putin when they spoke as recently as a week ago, last Thursday. Now, there is a telephone call, the Russian readout of a telephone call between Putin and the Prime Minister of Hungary, Viktor Orban, which took place several days ago, 6 days ago, on the 17th of October. In other words, the day after Putin and Trump spoke, which I checked out yesterday after I made my program, which puts the matter completely beyond doubt. This is what the Russian readout of that call says. Viktor Orban expressed willingness to lay the groundwork for holding a possible Russia-United States summit in Budapest. The president of Russia informed the Prime Minister of Hungary about key points of his conversation with US President Trump, pointing out that the upcoming engagements with representatives of the United States are to serve to discuss a plan of further action to search for ways to settle the Ukraine crisis, which would include, amongst other things, a possible top-level meeting between Russia and the United States to be held in the Hungarian capital. So notice the mass of qualifiers. Putin tells Orban that there's going to be discussions, a series of discussions, between upcoming engagements with representatives of the United States. In other words, conversations first and foremost between Lavrov and Rubio. And depending on how well those go, there might be a summit meeting between Trump and Putin in Budapest. It's absolutely crystal clear from this readout that Putin did not agree when he spoke to Trump to a meeting, did not commit to a meeting with Trump in Budapest, that it was Trump who proposed the idea of the meeting, and that Putin made Russia's agreement conditional on the discussions with the United States leading up to a possible meeting going well. And to repeat what I said at very great length in my program yesterday, it's quite clear that what Putin is now insisting upon is that Trump come back and provide concrete, definite, clear answers to the various points that Putin and Trump discussed with each other at the summit meeting that the two of them conducted back in August in Alaska. The Russians have been increasingly frustrated and angry that Trump has never come back on all of those various points in the way that he promised. And they have been infuriated by the reports that the United States was on the brink of deploying Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine. The conversation between Putin and Trump, which took place last Thursday, was intended by the Russians to make all of that clear to Trump, and to make it clear to Trump also that the Russians were now expecting answers. And Putin said to Orban when they spoke on Friday that the decision the Russian decision about whether or not to go ahead with the summit meeting in Budapest depended entirely on what answers the United States finally gave. Well, as I discussed also in my program yesterday, when it became clear on the Friday after the telephone conversation between Putin and Trump that Zelensky was not going to make the kind of concessions that the Russians are insisting upon, at the very least, a withdrawal of Ukrainian troops from Donbass, it was clear to Trump that he would come to the meeting, if there was going to be a meeting with Putin, empty-handed. It was not clear, in fact, that there would be a meeting at all, because the Russians might feel that since Trump was not coming back with any concrete answers to the points discussed in Alaska, there would be no point for a meeting between Putin and Trump in Budapest or anything of that kind. And Trump therefore decided that in light of that, he might as well call off the summit himself. That is what has happened. It is because Trump overpromised to Putin in Alaska, is unable to deliver, cannot come back and give concrete positive responses to the Russians over what was discussed in Alaska. That is the reason that Trump has called off the summit in Budapest, which Trump himself proposed. Anyway, that's historic now. Trump, of course, has gone to do more things. He says that he's not going to supply Tomahawks. He's got Putin's warnings about the Tomahawks ringing in his ears. But he's saying that the United States is not going to conduct or assist in the conduct of missile strikes against Russia. He's going to stick, in other words, to what he said in his interview with Time magazine before he became president, just after the last year's election, that he vehemently opposed missile strikes against Russia. Except that that almost certainly is not true. He's gone out on Truth Social and he said that reports in the Wall Street Journal that the United States is now facilitating missile strikes against Russia from Ukraine, perhaps using European missiles. He says that that is untrue. He says that the missiles that have been used, if they are being used, have nothing to do with the United States. That is what Trump is saying. Again, this is obviously false. The Wall Street Journal has made it clear that they're sticking by this story. There are reports in the British media that the authorization to supply help, assistance, intelligence information to carry out strikes, missile strikes against Russia has indeed been given. It was formally given by the US Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, and apparently missile strikes against Russia are now being coordinated by the Ukrainians with the US military chief, the US military commander of NATO, who is of course based in Europe. Now, a couple of days ago, the Ukrainians were claiming that they carried out an attack with Storm Shadow missiles against a chemical factory in Bryansk. The Russians have provided no confirmation of this, and so far, as of this time, there are no satellite photos showing what, in fact, has happened to that factory. But the Russians have said that their air defences on the day when this missile strike on the chemical factory in Bryansk took place, the Russians are saying that they did shoot down four cruise missiles. Probably, and this is my guess, the Russians are conducting an assessment, and at some point over the course of the next few days, we will see the Russian Defense Ministry provide its own account and discussion of this operation. I have no doubt that a missile strike using storm shadows on a factory in Bryansk region did take place. It may be that the attack was unsuccessful, but as I remember, was discussed at length in the British media last year when missile strikes with storm shadows and scalp missiles and attackers missiles took place against Russia during the time of the Biden administration. The British media themselves confirmed that because GPS does not work on Russian territory, the guidance systems of storm shadow missiles would depend on proprietary technology owned by the United States, and that these missiles could only be operated with the permission and with the assistance of the United States itself. So Trump, again, is, in my opinion, shaming himself by pretending that he is not involved in something that he has obviously himself agreed to and authorised. My friend Alex Christoforou has spoken in the past about a pattern of duplicity which has become very much a characteristic of this administration, of an attack on Iran on the eve of negotiations between Iranian and American representatives, of an attack on a Hamas delegation in Qatar, with the United States pretending complete ignorance and continuing to do so, by the way. We see the same happen since. The United States in July agreed to provide Ukraine with intelligence to conduct drone strikes deep inside Russia. This on the eve of the summit meeting between Putin and Trump in Alaska. And we now see the President of the United States engaging in these threadbare lies, pretending that what is obvious to the whole world, to the Russians, obviously, but even to his own media, that the United States is again facilitating missile strikes against Russian territory, that is not true. And I come back to what I was saying previously about the Tomahawks. Trump is saying that at the moment he is not supplying Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine because Ukrainians need many, many, many months to train and learn how to use them. And there is no possibility that the Americans will ever operate them in place of the Ukrainians, given that he is not telling the truth about the latest missile strikes on Russia. How can one believe that he is telling the truth about American operation of Tomahawk missiles in Ukraine, that it will never happen? Frankly, I don't believe that he has any credibility at all over this issue. Well, that's already something that must have angered the Russians still further. But there are other things that Trump has done which has angered them perhaps still more. Firstly, as I discussed again in my programme yesterday, he has, without any explanation or excuse, gone back on the public agreement he reached with Putin back in August in Alaska, that there would be negotiations to achieve a full and complete resolution of the conflict in Ukraine instead of a ceasefire. Trump agreed with Putin that a ceasefire was unworkable because almost certainly it would be immediately breached. He wrote as much in the Truth Social Post. He wrote after the meeting in Alaska. He is now again back to demanding a ceasefire, and a ceasefire on the existing conflict lines, something which the Russians have always rejected, and something which the Russians got Trump to agree was not viable when they met him in Alaska. So he has gone back on that without even admitting to the fact, without providing any explanation at all. And as I discussed in my program yesterday, the Russians are furious about it. Trump has now gone further still. In various programs on the Duran, Alex Christoforou and I agreed that if the point ever came where Donald Trump himself announced further sanctions against Russia, it would be a sign, finally, that he has taken ownership of the war. Last night, that is exactly what he did. Though, again, continuing this pattern of avoidance of responsibility, Trump allowed the US Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, to take centre stage on this. Last night, the United States announced sanctions against Russia's two biggest oil companies, Rosneft, which is state-owned, and Lukoil, which is a private company, and the various many subsidiaries and other companies within Russia that operate with them. Now, I'm going to anticipate quickly and briefly here by saying that these are not sanctions so much against Russia and against these particular oil companies. I cannot imagine that anybody in the United States or indeed in Europe has much dealings with Rosneft and Lukoil anymore. They are ultimately sanctions against India, a friend of the United States, which at American urging back in 2023 started to buy Russian oil. As I said, I will return to this topic later. But suffice to say that Trump has now done that which previously he did not do. He has sanctioned two big Russian companies, Rosneft and Lukoil, and he has said that he is doing it, or rather, his Treasury Secretary has said that the United States is doing it because Russia will not agree to a ceasefire. Precisely the ceasefire that Trump agreed with the Russians back in August was a bad idea, which should not therefore be pursued. Now, there is no good way to spin this. I suspect that the sanctions against Lukoil and Rosneft, for example, were partly, perhaps, intended to get pressure off Trump's back from people like Lindsey Graham and Richard Blumenthal, and perhaps for the Europeans, from the Europeans as well. But to me, once again, this looks devious and manipulative and ultimately weak. Instead of Trump briefly and simply telling the Russians, look, we had our discussion in Alaska, I've spoken to the Ukrainians, I've spoken to the Europeans, I've spoken to my people in Washington, I'm afraid what we discussed in Alaska simply won't fly. The Ukrainians are digging in their heels, so are the Europeans. I don't have the political weight in the United States by myself to make it stick. Instead of doing that, instead of giving a straightforward no for an answer to the Russians, he has engaged in this bizarre game of sanctions, weapons deliveries, except that they're not weapons deliveries, intelligence assistance, both to the Ukrainians and to the British and the French, who are assisting, and presumably before long, when the Taurus missiles start being used with the Germans to launch missiles against the Russians. And he has gone back without any explanation, without any justification, on what he and Putin agreed with each other back in August. I cannot myself see how credibility can be repaired from this point on. And already you're now getting stronger statements from people inside Russia that from this moment on, there is no more point in wasting time with Donald Trump. And these comments have now been made in public by the former president and prime minister of Russia and the vice chairman of Russia's Security Council and the man who ultimately heads, or who in practical terms heads, Russia's Military Industrial Commission, the former president Dmitry Medvedev. And Medvedev on Telegram has written this: Trump's cancellation of the summit in Budapest, new sanctions against our country from the USA. What else? Will there be new weapons besides the notorious Tomahawks? Note that Medvedev takes it in effect as a certainty that sooner or later the Tomahawks are indeed going to be supplied. Anyway, this is what Medvedev then goes on to say. If any of the numerous commentators still had illusions, here you go. The USA is our enemy, and their talkative peacemaker, and he puts the words peacemaker in quotation marks, has now fully taken up the path of war with Russia. Yes, he does not always actively fight on the side of Kiev yet, but this is how now he's conflict, not Biden's. Of course, they will say that he could not do otherwise, that he was pressured in Congress, etc. This changes nothing. The decisions made are an act of war against Russia, and now Trump has fully aligned himself with the mad people in Europe. But there is a clear plus in the next swing of the Trump pendulum. It is possible to strike with various weapons at all Banderite hideouts without looking back at unnecessary negotiations. That, by the way, is a clear hint that Russia should now start to undertake decapitation strikes at the Ukrainian leadership. Just to say. But anyway, to continue. And to achieve victory where it is only possible, on the battlefield, not behind a desk. Destroying enemies, not making meaningless deals. Now, Medvedev has a habit of using very strong terms and language, but, well, I've never known him to to write and speak about Trump in this manner. And of course, the person he's really addressing here is none other than Vladimir Putin himself. It is Vladimir Putin that he is speaking to. He's saying, look, all these illusions that you have had, that you can do a deal with Trump. You're not going to do a deal with Trump. Trump is incapable of doing a deal with you. He might have all kinds of excuses. He might say that he comes under pressure from Congress or from the neocons. What difference in the end does it make? The simple fact is that whatever Trump wishes, whatever his private desires might be, not only is he unable to act on them, but as you can see, he is in effect doing the opposite. He is launching or assisting Ukraine and the Europeans in conducting missile strikes against our country. He is again now sanctioning our economy, just as Joe Biden once did. He's gone back completely on what he agreed in Alaska in relation to the fact that ceasefires were a bad idea and unworkable. He's reverted in totality to the policy of Joe Biden. In fact, in some respects, he's gone beyond it. So there is no point any longer in wasting time with him. Focus instead on winning the war. Don't waste time with negotiations. You might as well go after Zelensky himself and the other people in Kiev. We have all the means to do that, because this war is not going to end through negotiations. It has to be won on the battlefield. So I have no doubt that Medvedev represents a strong current of opinion. I'm going to go further, a dominant current of opinion now in Moscow. Given the way Kremlin politics work, if he did not, he would not be able to write in this way. Because, to be clear, this is, if not exactly a rebuke of Putin, at least a criticism of him. When he talks about numerous commentators still having illusions, well, the person who spent most of the time having 8 telephone conversations with Trump and meeting Trump in Alaska, the person who had those illusions was Vladimir Putin himself. Now, Putin has not spoken over the last couple of hours. I don't think he will. I think as intelligent politicians who find themselves in this position will tend to do, I suspect that he will lie low for the next couple of days, that he will avoid discussions on these topics. But even he, after what has happened over the last couple of days, must sense that the end of the road has been reached. In fact, I would go further. I would suggest that the readout of his conversation with Orban essentially confirms it. Let's go back to that. There will be, and this is what Putin apparently said to Orban, upcoming engagements with representatives of the United States to discuss a plan of further action to search for ways to settle the Ukrainian crisis. Search for ways. So it doesn't look as if the discussions in Alaska really got very far. Perhaps they reached what Putin might have thought was first base, though we see that Trump has failed to deliver on even that. Regardless, they never went beyond first base. And from the tone of the Russian readout of Putin's conversation with Orban, it strongly suggests to me that by this point, even Putin himself was having serious doubts that this would go any further. Now, what makes this all really extraordinary is that the situation, the battlefield situation, is deteriorating for Ukraine increasingly fast, and that from this moment on, well, it's difficult, I think, to avoid a sense that some big events on the battlefronts are coming, and perhaps even an outright collapse of Ukrainian resistance in Donbass. And given that the entire discussions over the last couple of months have been about a potential Ukrainian withdrawal from Donbass, it does seem remarkable that Trump has, well, jeopardized at the very least, I suspect destroyed, his entire project of achieving some kind of dialogue with the Russians and rapprochement with the Russians on the hill of Ukrainian defense of Donbass, when that defense is giving every sign of being in the last stages of collapse. Over the last 24 hours, there's been a cascade of reports that the Ukrainians are now, I won't say retreating from Pokrovsk, I think more likely fleeing from Pokrovsk. As I've discussed in many programs, at several programs recently, Pokrovsk is, to all intents and purposes, encircled. The Russians control all the main supply roads. The Ukrainians have not been able to break through and to send supplies to Pokrovsk. It's been looking increasingly likely that the Russians were about to cut off the Ukrainian garrison in Mirnograd or off from the Russian garrison in Pokrovsk. I pointed out in recent programs that it was likely that the Ukrainians, before that happened, would flee Mirnograd to try to escape being encircled there and cut off from their fellow soldiers in Pokrovsk. And it seems that that is exactly what is happening. The reports say that a rear guard of about 1,000 Ukrainian troops has been left behind to try to hold back the Russians in southern Mirnograd, to be precise, in a coal mine and its slag heap that is located there, but that the rest of the garrison is fleeing out of Mirnograd towards Pokrovsk itself. In other words, that the whole of Mirnograd is being abandoned apart from this coal mine. I'm going to say straightforwardly that I think it is most unlikely that things are anywhere near as structured as that implies. I cannot imagine, for example, that those 1,000 troops in the coal mine have volunteered basically to destroy themselves so that their comrades can flee. I think much more likely what is happening is that the coal mine itself is now essentially surrounded by the Russians, and that is why the Ukrainian troops in that coal mine are not able to join the others and to flee from Mirnograd into Pokrovsk. But anyway, I'm not going to get into the details of this. Suffice to say that there is drone footage of northern Pokrov, of northern Mirnograd, provided by the Ukrainians themselves, in which they claim that they are monitoring particular set of buildings where supposedly a Russian sabotage and reconnaissance group is located. That appears to confirm the presence of Russian troops in northern Mirnograd, which reinforces my sense that that part of Mirnograd, in fact most of Mirnograd, has already effectively been abandoned. Now, of course, the paradox of this is that the Ukrainian troops fleeing Mirnograd to escape being caught in a cauldron there are actually fleeing from one cauldron into another. Because whilst Pokrovsk, northern Pokrovsk, areas of northern Pokrovsk, north of the railway lines, are closer to Ukrainian positions, I'm not sure that those positions are accessible, or at least easily accessible, to the Ukrainian troops in northern Pokrovsk. So, you could argue, in fact, I would argue, that those Ukrainian troops in northern Pokrovsk are themselves also in a cauldron. So I don't know how this plays out. We've seen it happen in many battles already, in Avdiivka, in Lysychansk, elsewhere, that just before the collapse comes, there is a chaotic exodus of Ukrainian troops. They can't use the main roads because the roads are basically covered by the Russian drones. So probably over nightfall, they try to flee across the fields. Bear in mind, it's now autumn and the fields are cold, and it's also the time of the Rasputitsa, so the fields are probably soggy and perhaps muddy in places. Anyway, they're going to try and escape, and they're going to try to escape to the north. The nearest village that the Ukrainians still hold, close to Pokrovsk itself, is Grishino, located just to the northwest of Pokrovsk. But in order to reach Grishino, they need to cross all of these soggy, cold, wet fields, presumably at night, with the Russian drones, many of which, as I've said previously, have night vision devices, and which are now fiber optic drones, mostly, buzzing overhead. Well, I don't want to even begin to describe the pure and complete horror that this is likely to be. But anyway, the key thing is that it does seem to me as if Pokrovsk, it does look as if Pokrovsk is about to collapse. There is a long article in the Daily Telegraph, appeared yesterday in fact, which talks mostly about Russian war crimes inside Pokrovsk. I'm not going to discuss those allegations. If you drill through it, you will find there an admission that Pokrovsk is indeed on the brink of falling. And the article was clearly, or so it seems to me, an attempt by the British media, and whoever briefs them, to prepare the British public for the fact that Pokrovsk is now about to fall. Now, in relation to the Battle of Pokrovsk, there is one particular point I want to make, There is a narrative, there are always these narratives, that has been circulating widely in the media, that the Battle of Pokrovsk has lasted a full year, that the Russians reached Pokrovsk in late summer of 2024, that it has taken them a whole year to capture Pokrovsk, that this has been a heroic and gallant defence, and that the fact that the capture of Pokrovsk has taken the Russians a full year shows how chaotic and disorganised and incompetent the Russian army is. That narrative is false. The Russians did indeed reach the outskirts of Pokrovsk in the late summer of 2024. But to the surprise of many people, myself included, they made no assault upon Pokrovsk at that time. Instead, they turned south and conducted what turned out to be an exceptionally successful operation to capture a whole cluster of important towns, Selidovo, Kurakovo, Ugleda, Novogrodivka, and ultimately Velikaya Novosilka, to the south. And the capture of all of this territory has been essential to enable the Russian offensive in Zaporozhye region towards the river, which is now underway. If one is talking about the Battle of Pokrovsk itself, the Russian assault on Pokrovsk began in earnest as recently as August of this year, and its collapse, the collapse of Ukrainian resistance in Pokrovsk, has happened actually by the standards of this war, given the size and importance of Pokrovsk, the complexity of the town, the fact that it includes many micro-districts with high-rise buildings and several coal mines with their terracons, the collapse has come very fast. Anyway, that is the situation today, as I understand it, in Pokrovsk. I've discussed in many programmes the importance of Pokrovsk, the way that the fall of Pokrovsk potentially opens the way for the Russians to advance westwards, also towards the river, towards the important city of Pavlograd, and beyond that, ultimately, to the great industrial city of Dnipro, if that is what the Russians decide to do. I think more likely what the Russians will do once they have completed the Battle of Pokrovsk is push north, outflanking the Ukrainian defences, remaining Ukrainian defences in Donbass, in effectively encircling the Ukrainians in the line of cities Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, Konstantinovka, which remain the last effective remaining barrier that the Ukrainians have in Donbass. And the fall of Pokrovsk makes that envelopment operation much more likely. It almost certainly, in fact, it definitely seals the fate of the southernmost of these towns, Konstantinovka, where fighting within the city is already taking place. And it means that Ukrainian supply routes to the Ukrainian troops in Slavyansk, Kramatorsk from the south are effectively now cut off. Before long, they will be cut off from the north as well. There's been more adjustments by the various mapping projects about the situation in Kupiansk. The various maps the Ukrainians are providing have, and the reports the Ukrainians are providing, have even caused the neutral mappers, as they're sometimes called, in other words, the Western mappers, to adjust their maps. They appear to confirm that all of Kupiansk, all of the urban residential areas of Kupiansk on the west bank of the Oskol River are now under Russian control. The Ukrainians have still a sizable grouping in the industrial area of Kupiansk on the east bank of the Oskol River. But mostly, it is the Russians who control the east bank of the Oskol River. And those Ukrainian troops on the east bank are essentially trapped. I'm going to make a guess that after the fall of Pokrovsk, there'll be instructions from Moscow to finish the battle for Kupiansk. There'll be no further reason to keep that battle going. And we will probably see Kupiansk, the final end of the battle for Kupiansk itself and for the troops trapped, the Ukrainian troops trapped on the east bank of the Oskol River, happen fairly quickly. And there are lots of reports now of the Russians being on the outskirts or perhaps having even entered Liman to the east of Slavyansk. There's said to be fighting taking place there. It's widely acknowledged that Liman itself is not an easy place to defend. The Ukrainians were unable to defend it successfully when the Russians attacked it in 2022. And the Russians only were able to hold out in Liman for a few weeks, as I remember, when it was the turn of the Ukrainians in the autumn of 2022 to return to Liman and to recapture it. So it is likely that Liman will fall, and the fall of Liman will doom any remaining Ukrainian troops still holding out in Siversk. That battle, by the way, continues to be underway. Siversk more heavily fortified and having a topography more suitable to defence than Liman itself does. But to repeat again, the fall of Liman, the fall of Siversk, the fall of Kupiansk opens the way for the Russians to push south, to recapture Izium, Balaklaya, to finally and entirely reverse the gains of Ukraine's autumn 2022 counteroffensive, and to cut the supplies to the Slavyansk Kramatorsk conurbation from the north. And there are no other major supply roads leading to this conurbation from the west. If the Russians control the roads and the railway lines from Pokrovsk and Izium, the Ukrainian forces in Slavyansk Kramatorsk are essentially in an operational encirclement. And over the course of a recent live stream we did with him, Brian Beletic, he of the New Atlas, one of the indispensable programs that need to be followed, channels that need to be followed in order to understand this conflict, pointed out that Russian drone operators in Liman with fiber optic drones could interfere, could attack Ukrainian traffic on the roads leading to Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, and would certainly be able to operate effectively in conjunction with other Russian fiber optic drone operators operating from the south, from Pokrovsk, and no doubt positions to the north of Pokrovsk once Pokrovsk is captured. And that would already create an effective encirclement of the Ukrainian troops in Slavyansk and Kramatorsk even before Izium and Balaklaya had been recaptured by the Russians. So, again, it's perhaps unwise to place dates or timetables. But one can see now that we are close to the end point of the battle for Donbass. This has been a complex and difficult battle. The Russians have had to capture one fortified town after another, but they are in this complex chess game that has had to be fought in Donbass, very close to a checkmate position. So, why jeopardize everything? Why place the entire negotiation between the United States and Russia at risk? Because Mr. Zelensky, backed by his European friends, refuses to face reality and withdraw his troops from Donbass. I am completely unable to understand this. I get the fact that Trump himself and his officials, the people perhaps who think closest to him, understand the enormous political pressures upon them in Washington and in the United States from those who want to keep the war going indefinitely and still hanker to weaken Russia and isolate Russia in some way. But the fact is that this is illogical. It makes no sense. And I cannot imagine that another president, a really strong and decisive president, a President Kennedy, or indeed a President Nixon, or a President Reagan, would have allowed themselves to be manoeuvred into this kind of situation. But there it is. Ultimately, as Medvedev has said in his Telegram post, it really doesn't matter at the end of the day whether we're dealing with Trump's own indecision, his fears of being blamed for the failure in Ukraine, or whether he's intimidated by all of the hardliners around him, or whether he himself at some level is a hardliner. The result is the same. The whole policy of US-Russia rapprochement has been sacrificed to prolong a battle, the Battle of Donbass, which is already lost. Now, beyond that, and this is where we come back to the points that Medvedev is making, and by the way, which Lavrov has also been making, which is that for the Russians, this is not a war just about Donbass. When the special military operation was launched, President Putin set out its objectives, and he has always insisted that all of these objectives must be achieved. And the Russians always return to these objectives, even if people in the West don't. And Putin has talked about the rights of Russian speakers, the Ukraine's neutrality, its non-alignment, its position, its status as a neutral country outside NATO. He has talked about the denuclearization, demilitarization of Ukraine. He has talked about the denazification of Ukraine. He's talked about all of these things. As Medvedev has pointed out on many occasions, as other Russian officials have at various times said, as many, many Russians also say, and as Sergei Lavrov let slip for the first time in his press conference with the Ethiopian foreign minister, which I discussed in my programme yesterday, it is impossible to see how any of these objectives can be fully achieved without a change of government, regime change in Kiev. And, well, maybe if there'd been some kind of negotiations between the Russians and the Americans to settle the war, this might have been done in an orderly way. But with the loss of Donbass, the United States will have lost its main point of leverage over the Russians. Maybe the Americans don't understand that, but that will be the reality. For the Russians, there will still be an awful lot more to do. And the Americans and the Ukrainians will no longer be in a position to trade or to offer to trade Donbass in return for Russian concessions over it. So I cannot imagine, for example, that the Russians are going to be so willing now to give up claims to Zaporozhye and Kherson region. I cannot imagine that the Russians are going to be as willing from this point onwards to make concessions on all sorts of other of the essential points that they have set out. And of course, with the fall of Donbass, with the fall of what even the Institute of the Study of War and the various media outlets in the West acknowledge was Ukraine's great fortified line, the Russians probably feel under no real pressure to make those concessions. Now, this is where I'm going to come back to the topic of the sanctions that the Trump administration has now imposed. The sanctions purportedly, in fact, actually, are against Lukoil and Rosneft. But of course, as I've said already, the European Union doesn't really do much business with these companies. And of course, the United States doesn't do so either. The European Union, continuing on its policy of committing economic suicide, has now committed itself to stopping all further imports of liquefied natural gas that from Russia. This, it has just announced in the 19th sanctions package, which it has just put through. Well, the major buyers of liquefied natural gas from Russia, I suspect from now on anyway, are going to be the Chinese. The Chinese have started to buy Russian LNG, even from Russian LNG facilities that are under US sanctions, and no doubt they will continue to do that. The Europeans have been gradually buying more and more LNG from Russia because it is much cheaper than LNG from the United States. And the United States, its ability to keep supplying LNG to Europe is probably finite, because I've heard in many places, and I believe, that the shale revolution is now running its course, and that production of natural gas, and indeed of oil, in the United States has either peaked or is close to its peak, and in the next few years is likely to fall. But anyway, let's focus on the latest sanctions, which are on the sanctions against Rosneft and Lukoil. The United States, President Trump, back in July, threatened to impose 100% tariffs on India and China if they continue to buy Russian oil, and if the Russians rejected his demands for an immediate ceasefire. The Russians predictably continued to refuse the demands for a ceasefire. Trump backed off imposing 100% SAT tariffs on India or China. He did impose significant tariffs on India, but the Indians made it clear that they would continue to buy Russian oil despite that. And so the United States, which has spent the last couple of weeks, months in fact, piling up the pressure on India and on Prime Minister Modi in particular, have now taken the next step, which is to sanction these two Russian oil companies. And of course, the threat is not to these oil companies, but to the Indian refiners. If the Indian refiners buy oil from these companies, crude oil from these companies, then they are at risk of being sanctioned by the United States themselves. And there is also, they might also have problems, or so it is said, processing banking transactions. They might find themselves cut out of the dollar. Now, in the hours after this sanctions announcement, the financial media published a whole cluster of articles. You find them in Reuters, the Financial Times, and Bloomberg, which say that following the American sanctions, the Indian refiners are now preparing or planning to stop buying Russian oil. And they claim to have had information about this from the refiners themselves, though none of the refiners have in fact confirmed it, except one, which is owned by India's richest man, Mr. Ambani, that they are recalibrating their oil purchases in accordance with guidance that they are receiving from the Indian government. Now, I would say straight away that I think one should be extremely careful about these kind of articles that appear in places like Bloomberg, Reuters, and the Financial Times. As I have already discussed in many places, these media outlets get a lot of their information from Western governments. And in fact, I have no doubt that articles that appear from time to time in these publications are planted by Western governments. Reuters, in particular, in my opinion, has an unhealthily strong connection to the British authorities, just to say. I suspect that these articles that we are seeing are a case in point. If you go to the Indian media, as I regularly do, by the way, what you find is that all of the major Indian newspapers have syndicated places where they basically reproduce stories in Bloomberg, the Financial Times, and Reuters. So planting an article in Bloomberg, the Financial Times, and Reuters about the Indian oil industry all but guarantees that that same article will be republished, sometimes in slightly rearranged form, in the Indian media as well. So keep all that in mind. There is clearly a major campaign to get India to adhere to these sanctions and to stop buying Russian oil. And it is likely that over the next couple of weeks, perhaps months, there will be indeed a major recalibration. And the reason for that is that at least one of these big refiners, the one that is being most talked about, is part of a major Indian economic group, industrial group, owned apparently by India's richest man, who has close connections to Prime Minister Modi, and by the way, to President Trump's family, just to say. Anyway, he is an international businessman with many operations around the world. He will not want trouble with the US authorities, and he will want his businesses to be able to access the Western financial system and to be able to use dollars. However, there's a number of things that need to be said here. Firstly, as I understand it, Indian refineries do not buy their oil directly from Rosneft and Lukoil. They don't actually have direct dealings, or mostly don't have direct dealings with these two Russian oil companies. There is one big refinery in India which perhaps does, but apparently that refinery is partly owned by Rosneft, just to say. So it presumably is able, could be willing to access Russian oil directly from Rosneft, because it's already, in a sense, part of the extended family of Rosneft operations. Interestingly, that particular refiner, despite its connection to Rosneft, has not itself been sanctioned by the United States. So already there are openings for the trade in oil between Russia and India to continue, if of course there is the will to do it. You can always say, well, you know, this isn't actually, we have nothing to do with Rosneft and with Lukoil. If this oil comes to us, it comes from somewhere. We don't know what goes on inside Russia itself. We're dealing with multiples of third parties, and that is the way that it is done. And enforcement of sanctions becomes very difficult. And if you're one of the world's richest men, as this owner of this refinery apparently is, he is a person whose wealth is in the hundreds of billions of dollars, just saying. Well, you can always find people you can talk to, and you can negotiate cutouts, and you've got your friends in Washington, if of course it is still your wish to buy Russian oil. And I am going to make a guess that India will indeed still want, in some form, to continue to buy Russian oil. They might reduce the amount they buy, they might mix it with other oils or pretend to, they might do any one of these things. But ultimately, the economic advantage of buying Russian oil for India remains too strong. And it is important to say that India's national oil company is apparently a state-owned company of India itself. What will happen over the next couple of weeks, over the next couple of months, is that there will be the usual complex series of discussions. The workarounds will be sorted out. Probably some people in Washington will be advised of them. I suspect the United States itself is going to be very, very wary of starting to sanction major Indian business interests, given the effect that that might have in India, and everything will settle down and the oil trade will continue. If not exactly, then very much like before. And ultimately, that is what the president himself is going to want. Already, over the last couple of hours, even as these sanctions have been announced, there's been a jump in the price of oil. It is not in his interests to see the oil price rise. He doesn't want more inflation pressure in the United States. Again, this looks to me like something that Donald Trump has basically hit on in order to try to find ways to gain leverage over the Russians and perhaps to placate the hardliners in Congress. But I doubt that the enforcement in the end is going to be that strong, because of the blowback potentially back in the United States. If I am wrong about this, and if India does indeed intend to stop buying Russian oil. Well, what that will do is make oil prices higher than they would otherwise be. That will increase demand for oil because there will, over time, be an oil shortage. The Russians will be able to continue to sell their oil in spot markets, and they have an absolutely reliable customer in China, which has made it absolutely clear that it intends to continue to buy Russian oil, regardless of any sanctions and other threats from the United States. It is even buying oil, buying liquefied natural gas now from sanctioned Russian LNG producers. And over time, again, I suspect everything will balance out and we will find that the economic effects on the Russians of this are relatively slight. The Russians have shrugged their shoulders about the latest news. The Russian Foreign Ministry has said that these latest sanctions are going to have marginal effect, that Russia has now learnt to adapt and live with sanctions, and that is true. And going back to the Financial Times article, I noticed that it has quietly, without any fanfare, reduced its claimed share of revenues to the Russian budget from oil and gas sales. It's previously, as has been the case with many many media outlets in the West, claimed that the Russian budget depends up to 50% on Russian oil and gas sales. It's now quietly revised that down to 25%, which is what I have been saying all along. And by the way, and for the record, even if that entire 25% were to disappear, which it won't, because bear in mind, even if Russia exports no oil and gas at all, there is still a massive market for Russian oil and gas in Russia itself. I believe that Russian oil and gas producers around, well, a very large part of their business, perhaps the greater part of their business, is in Russia, and they will continue to pay taxes on that business anyway. Anyway, the Russians can always find ways to compensate for any reduction in receipts from exports by raising taxes in Russia, by borrowing in Chinese financial markets, as apparently they're now able to do in all sorts of ways. I've discussed this in many places, many times. What this latest thing has done, this latest sanctions announcement has done, is damage in the meantime even further the relations between India and the United States and between Prime Minister Modi of India and President Trump. Today, the Indian Prime Minister's office has confirmed that Modi will not be travelling to Malaysia to attend the forthcoming ASEAN summit. He will participate in this summit virtually, but he will not actually go. And the Indian media are straightforwardly giving the reason. He doesn't want to go to Malaysia to attend the ASEAN summit because Trump is also intending to go and he doesn't want to meet Trump. He doesn't want to have another meeting with Donald Trump. Now, that is extraordinary, given that they're friends, but given that President Trump has recently been making up entire conversations with Prime Minister Modi, telephone conversations which never happened, over the course of which Prime Minister Modi supposedly assured him that India will stop buying Russian oil before the end of the year. If that had been true, by the way, we wouldn't have seen the sanctions that we saw against Rosneft and Lukoil yesterday. Anyway, given that President Trump has been making up conversations like that, it is entirely understandable that Modi, for the moment at least, wants to limit his contacts with Trump as far as possible. Now, this brings me to my very last point in today's programme. I don't know whether Trump himself realises this, but over the last month, he has massively damaged his reputation with most of the big international players. China is furious with him. They were angry with him because of the tariffs that he imposed on China in April, in April this year. They then thought they had agreed a pause with Trump, or rather with Trump's administration, and were expecting negotiations after the terms of the pause were finalised in September, negotiations leading eventually to a trade deal. There'd be no negotiations. The United States instead has applied salami slicing tactics, imposing more and more sanctions and tariffs on China. The Americans themselves have now admitted that one of the points that particularly angered the Chinese was the fees, the port fees, on Chinese-built ships that come to American ports. These are not, these don't have to be ships operated by Chinese ship owners, simply ships operated by ship owners from anywhere in the world, but apparently built in China. The Chinese were furious about this. They're now stopping imports of advanced chips designed in the United States. They're not buying any longer NVIDIA chips. They've tightened up significantly controls on exports of rare earths. There are reports that they're taking further steps. Apparently, they've stopped exports of the billions of chips made by Expedia, the Chinese company, Chinese-owned company based in the Netherlands. Apparently, there was no understanding that most of its production is now based in China, and that the chips this country produces are needed for the European car and American car industries. So the Chinese are tightening up, and they are also apparently cooling on the idea of a summit meeting between President Trump and Xi. Modi, as we see, is now avoiding Trump. He's staying away from the ASEAN summit. And, well, I hardly need to discuss how Putin must be feeling. And, well, we've just seen what Medvedev has just said. Trump may imagine himself the great deal maker, but far from making deals with the people that matter, he is isolating himself, he's making himself toxic, and by extension, the United States. Well, this is where I'm going to finish my program today. be more from me soon. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this program, please remember to tick the like button, and also please remember to check us out on Substack. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.